rest of your life.
This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we listen and we answer all of your health questions as we listen to you on this program, and you email us at info@alessimd.com. I'm happy to take your questions on the air if you email them over to me, especially about today's guest. I'm very proud to have as my guest my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa, and we're going to be talking about an exciting program she has as director of the sports neurology program at the Eyer Neuroscience Institute at Hartford Hospital. We're back to sports, right, folks? I mean, youth sports are in full gear. We're talking football, soccer, hockey. And we're starting to see more concussions as they come through our practices. So the question becomes, what have we learned about concussion? And what can we do going forward to be proactive as parents and grandparents? So we're going to be discussing that with her in the second half of today's program. As always, I like to give everybody an update on where we are with vaccinations. So vaccine, the new vaccine is available if you can find it. And that's become the issue. I tried to get my vaccine on Friday at Walgreens. I had an appointment and fortunately showed up early, and there were a group of people there, and we were being told that they had run out of vaccine. Now, I think as a courtesy, what they should do is let you know. If you have an appointment, they have your email, let you know that they're out of vaccine so you don't make a trip there. I especially felt bad for people who were there in walkers and wheelchairs to get their vaccine and being turned away. And I don't want to hear it that they can't get in touch with you, because let's face it, they get in touch with us every time greeting cards are on sale at Walgreens or toilet paper. So they could certainly reach out to people and say that at these sites we are out of the vaccine. Now, I am sure there'll be plenty of vaccine around. I know I checked over at CVS and they have it. I'll be trying to make another appointment. So obviously, once the new vaccine comes out, and this is the time we should be getting, there's this big rush of people who want to get vaccinated. So once again, as I mentioned last week, check with your pharmacy. Give them a call before you go, because they won't necessarily reach out to you in terms of getting the vaccine. This day in medicine, September 23rd, 2020, 1518. And on this day, the Royal College of Physicians was chartered to conduct qualifying exams for physicians. So again, very interesting. So this is 1518 where they started qualifying physicians. And there are now a plethora of exams for physicians to take. It's actually become a cottage industry for some groups. So there are certain exams that you take that are crucial to your practice. Obviously, your licensing exams to get licensed in states. Although, once you get that, you still have to apply. There's no universal licensing or automatic reciprocity between states. Again, the cottage industry. So if you wanted to apply for a license in another state, you have to pay. And licenses are not cheap. They vary probably between $500 and $700 per year. So if you want to practice in multiple states, you have to pay the fees. But again, there are these exams. So I said the crucial ones are obviously your licensing exam, then your specialty exam. So for example, for me, it would be in neurology. And then a subspecialty board, such as mine in neuromuscular disease. But then there are other organizations, you know, to become part of our organization, you need to take another exam, and none of these exams are inexpensive for physicians. I feel bad for young physicians because they have to pay out of pocket. Your institution doesn't pay for you to take the exam to do things like that, even if you are fully employed at the institution. So licensing, board certification, key things, and key to be able to take exams, whether they be written exams, oral exams, practical exams where you are examined in front of a patient who you do an exam on. These are crucial to really upholding the quality of care in the country. And that came to us on September 23rd, 1518. Also this date I wanted to mention, September 23rd, 1939, Sigmund Freud passed away. Now, we always hear his name and the Freudian school of psychoanalytics. I mean, he was a neurologist in Austria who founded psychoanalysis. And when we think of psychoanalysis, basically it is where he links physical pathology and associates it with the psyche or your mind and your ability to think. And we got terms like free association, transference, dream analysis was from Freud, repression, ego, superego. And we use those things today. Many of you will know we talked a lot about the ACEs program or the ACEs scale, which is adverse childhood experiences, where when you look at experiences in a child, you can often correlate these with disease as adults. Things like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, again, can be related to experiences they had as children. And this all comes with the work of Sigmund Freud. So important to note and to remember the day he died in 1939. Interesting, too. He escaped Austria when the Nazis came in 1938 and eventually died. He was Jewish and he escaped and died in exile, actually, in the United Kingdom. The NFLPA has asked the NFL to go to all grass fields. And the call has gone out once again. Many of you who are Jets fans and watch the game where Aaron Rodgers tore his Achilles tendon. And these studies have been done by the NFLPA over the past several years, looking at the injury rates for lower extremity injuries, right? We're talking about foot, ankle, and knee, and researched this in relation to artificial turf and natural turf. And it is clear that there are fewer lower extremity injuries on natural turf. So people will say, well, why is this? And that's because grass gives way. So any of you out there who are gardeners or even golfers know that when you hit that ground hard, you'll slide. Your golf club slides, you will slide off natural turf. On artificial turf, you don't have that give. And therefore, there's torque put on the lower extremity joints. We see a lot of toe injuries, ankle injuries, as I said, knee injuries are really. And so what's happening is, and what has to be explained is, the NFL is losing a lot of players, some of their hallmark players. And athletes are entertainers. They're performers. So when you start losing your best performers, you're losing revenue. So it's important for them to take note that it's time to go back to natural turf. Now, what's also interesting about this is, and something I didn't know, that FIFA, the soccer organization, International Soccer Organization, will not play games on artificial turf. So in 2026, when the World Cup comes to the United States, these fields that they want to play on, including Gillette Stadium, have to convert to natural turf. So it's a huge expense, but if you want the revenue of being a World Cup stadium, you're going to have to make the change. odd that we could make the change so we could host the World Cup. I guess my question is, how many fields are going to stay that way? Now, we are very fortunate here because we have Rentschler Field in East Hartford, where I will be later today for UConn and Duke playing football, and it is natural turf. It also raises the question, not just of cost, but what are we going to do with high school and college? Every high school wants an artificial turf field. Why? Cheaper to maintain. High upfront cost, cheaper to maintain. But we're seeing those injuries, so we haven't really talked about the young athletes who are not making it to advanced levels because of this type of injury. So anyhow, it'll be interesting for us to watch from an injury standpoint to see what stadiums go to natural turf. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to discuss an interesting topic in neurology, locked-in syndrome. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And in this segment of the program, I wanted to talk about two articles that I came across recently that I thought bared mentioning. And the first was a study done in Norway, published in the Journal of the American Academy of Neurology. And it looked at the clinical characteristics of a population-based sample of long-lasting locked-in syndrome. So for those of you unfamiliar with locked-in syndrome, it is a rare syndrome. And what it typifies is someone who has quadriplegia, can't move their limbs, mute, they can't speak, but they have intact consciousness and can communicate only by eye movements and blinking. And that's it. Now, many of you may have read or seen about it in The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which was a book published, and I think it's actually a movie, or actually an old movie, Johnny Got His Gun. This is among the most frightening things that can happen to you. Usually it is the result of a stroke, and the stroke affects the brainstem, where you have control of your brain functions. And what you see in these patients is that the cortex, the thinking part of the brain, remains intact, but everything below that is not working. So this study was done in Norway, where they looked at 51 patients. So the assumption has always been that these people passed away and did not necessarily recover or live. And yet in this study, they looked at 51 patients. So this was an interesting study because even to get 51 patients, this is not something we commonly see. It's not something you see typically with trauma. You don't usually see this at all with a brain tumor or any of the other things. You see this with a very specific stroke that affects a very specific area of the brainstem and essentially disconnects the brain from the body, except for thinking. So in this study, they looked at 51 patients, and all the patients, the median age was 55 years of age. So again, not a very elderly population. And what they found was that over the course of, 5 years, that 20 of these patients actually were still alive of the 51. 16 of the patients still had locked-in syndrome, and 15 had died. What's also interesting is that whether you live or die with locked-in syndrome is obviously heavily dependent on the level of care you receive and how others care for you, helping to avoid pneumonia, avoiding bed sores, other infections, because you can't move anything. So I have to say the fact that 20 people survived, okay, this number of years was pretty interesting and really a credit to the level of care they received in long-term care. The 20 people who survived did not go back to normal. It's not that they suddenly were walking and talking, but often they did regain speech and regain some level of partial function, possibly moving a little bit and things such as that. But they still required a great deal of care. And the 15 people who died did die of other reasons. They did not have additional strokes, but did develop other problems. You can have pulmonary emboli, any number of complications. So I thought it was just an interesting study to report on, and something that is frightening for all of us and that we see in the movies and read about in books. The other study was an interesting one because it looked at the sense of smell as cognitive screening tests along with cognitive tests. So if you combine cognitive screening tests with the sense of smell, how predictive was that of people developing dementia? So in this study, it was done here in the United States, they looked at a large Medicare population, primarily in Pittsburgh and in Memphis, Tennessee. And they administered a test, which was done. It was a 12-item brief smell identification test. So they give you a variety of things to smell to see if you can get them correct. And what the reason for this is, our sense of smell or olfaction comes in. The nerves are in the same area of the brain, right, the hippocampus, where you have memories, and we think is a principal area that affects dementia. So what they did was, in doing these studies, when linked with cognitive decline to assess dementia, they found that people who had a preserved sense of smell in their elderly years were less likely. So odor identification testing, when paired with global cognitive testing, identified individuals who were at low risk of transition to dementia. So something we don't think about very much in terms of sense of smell as we get older can be somewhat predictive of developing dementia. Now, it's not the final test. I could smell, so I can't be demented. But it is an indicator, and I find it interesting because of its relation to the area of the brain that where we see people developing dementia. There are a few small items I wanted to touch on. Here's an interesting one, tattoos. 32% of adults in the United States have tattoos. And 22% have more than one. I guess I didn't realize it was that that common, although I probably should have. Women to men, about 38% to 27%. And most get them to honor someone. I think the number was almost 70% of them were to honor someone who had passed or someone in their lives or a child. The reason I bring this up is it's important to know where you're getting the tattoo in terms of the health practices of that place. Why? Obviously, whenever anything pierces the skin, you could develop an infection. So sanitary codes need to be abided by and followed. You can have an allergy to dye. So again, important not just from developing a skin allergy, but if you were to develop some type of anaphylaxis, that place should have an EpiPen or something like that nearby. And then obviously there's skin irritation where people will develop keloids. So many people of all ages are out, you know, getting tattoos. I only ask, and I think it's important that people really look at where they're getting it done, like any procedure you have done, and making sure that they follow safe practices. Today, there was a thing in the paper about a gentleman who had a heart transplant from a genetically modified pig. And I think this is a great thing. You'll remember there was one of these performed recently where the person lived 2 months. They're hoping to get more time out of that. This man was certainly going to die from heart failure in a short period of time, and he opted to give it a try. And certainly he's awake and oriented and speaking to his family, and we are all praying for him in his survival, and also for the science behind this, because this can really change the field of organ transplantation. When you can genetically modify an organ from an animal that could be transplanted to a human, you know, so many people, and I know we talk about it a lot on this program and love working with the various organ donation organizations, and find out, you know, how this can benefit in terms of other organs. So we'll be watching that as that story develops. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my guest today, my daughter, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa, who's Director of Sports Neurology at the Iyer Neuroscience Institute at Hartford Hospital. We're going to be talking about concussion, specifically in children, your grandchildren, and what can you do to be proactive to help them avoid concussion, and if they have a concussion, assure that they're going to be able to recover safely. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you this afternoon. And especially, I am grateful to welcome my guest, Dr. Stephanie Alessi LaRosa, my daughter, who is director of the Sports Neurology Program at Hartford Hospital and the Iyer Neuroscience Institute in Hartford. And her practice is dedicated to sports neurology. And as we mentioned at the outset of the program, this is busy season for sports neurologists because of everything coming together. Back to school, we have football, soccer, hockey, and we're starting to see more and more head injuries. And we're hearing from more and more concerned parents and grandparents about head injuries. So I thought it was appropriate to have her on the program and talk about some of the things you're doing at Hartford Healthcare to help us be proactive in this field. Stephanie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dad.
All right. So let's get right down to it. Just let's tell everybody, what is a concussion? Because it's such a vague term. And I often say, when I was in medical school and residency in neurology, I never heard the term concussion more than five times. And now we can't go a day without hearing the term. So can you define for all our listeners what makes up a concussion?
Sure. A concussion is a transient injury, and it's the result of a biomechanical force that reaches the brain. And it causes a number of neurologic symptoms, as most people are aware of. And but it really is a functional disturbance and not a gross structural injury, meaning you cannot see it on a CAT scan or an MRI because it doesn't cause structural injury at that level.
So what are some of the more likely symptoms that we see early on if we're suspecting someone of having a concussion after they've had a biomechanical force or a blow to the brain?
The common symptoms, the most common one is headaches. And then from there, folks can have light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, nausea that are from the headache itself, as well as neck strain and dizziness or eye tracking issues, balance problems, memory difficulty, all kinds of symptoms. If you think of anything that the brain handles, which is everything, it can do a lot of things.
You know, we always used to think that it was an immediate onset of symptoms, but as we've seen it takes some time for the symptoms to take effect. What would be the time frame that you use as a reliable indicator of whether or not we're seeing a concussion?
Yeah, I agree. A lot of symptoms do not occur in the first hour or two. Sometimes they can, but really it can take 24, even 48 hours for some of the symptoms to develop or for the full syndrome to really take effect. So it can reveal itself over a little bit of time.
What are the more likely sports where you're going to see this? I mean, in terms of numbers, I guess football being the number one sport from that standpoint. But what are some of the other sports we're starting to see more young athletes have concussions?
Certainly football, but then, of course, ice hockey is another collision sport. Lacrosse is another one. And basketball can have a number of injuries as well. And this time of year, really, soccer can produce a number of injuries due to the, you know, collision and the running and the fast pace of running and contact.
You know, to a large degree, we've gotten rid of heading the ball in young children. Has that still been a factor even after the restrictions on heading the ball?
I think that's helped. You know, as much as we can reduce exposure to head injuries, or, you know, that really does prevent concussion. But, you know, it's still part of the game. And so at the youth level, that's important. But I think even in high school and collegiate levels, you know, heading the ball still occurs. And, you know, it can cause an issue. Yeah.
You know, Steph, we're often seeing people come up with the CTE, I don't know, for lack of a better term, the CTE paranoia. You know, I would see it a lot in older athletes who are retired from playing football, either collegiate or NFL, this concern of whether or not they were going to develop this entity of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But now we're starting to see it in younger athletes. Can you take this one head on? Because I think it's important for the public to have a clear understanding of CTE other than what the PR efforts have been.
Yeah, I agree. It's very important. And the media has not been helpful, I think, from a sports neurologist standpoint in giving the right message or the most accurate message. So chronic traumatic encephalopathy, as you know, is diagnosed post-mortem. So after somebody passes away, it cannot be diagnosed in a living person for this reason, because it is a tissue diagnosis. So they have to have a sample of the brain tissue in order to make this diagnosis. So the idea that someone is walking around with CTE is just not accurate based on where the research stands today. There have been no studies that are cause and effect studies, we would call them, where you can say head injury causes CTE. We don't have any studies that can actually say that, because the gold standard of research for cause and effect studies is what we call case control studies, where there's some people who are cases of this and of this condition, and then, you know, controls, which are normal people as well. There's really no case control studies out there. They can only do these things post-mortem. So it's a challenge, because we, you know, there's conclusions being drawn that I think are sort of dangerous, because a lot of people have this extra anxiety and extra fear around playing sports, when really, especially at the youth level, you know, I really encourage people to still play sports, because there's more benefits than risks. And, you know, kids get concussions on the playground. They get concussions in their day-to-day life. It's not just sports that are causing these things. It's almost a part of life. So I really don't like that the messaging is really discouraging people from playing sports. And where we know the information is now, it just isn't where the media has placed it.
When we see people, though, I mean, there are instances where you advise someone to not go back to a contact sport. And can you tell us some about what are some of the things you see in an athlete where you say, listen, this is enough, enough is enough? What kind of things come up on your exam and history in that case?
Sure. Retirement from sports is a case-by-case decision. You know, it really needs to be thought of as a dynamic decision between the athlete and what we're seeing on examination. and what they're experiencing in their day-to-day life. One of the most common reasons for an athlete to retire is that they're just no longer tolerating their sport. It's producing too many symptoms, and they don't want to really deal with them anymore. And so they end up choosing to retire essentially on their own, but after an evaluation where we can, you know, give some more information, and then they can make the decision on their own. Certainly if after our testing that we do, you know, office testing, MRI testing, neuropsychology testing, some of these other examinations to evaluate their overall function. If we're seeing anything alarming, there are some real changes, then we can also make that recommendation for them to stop. But it really is case by case. It is not dependent on how many concussions somebody's had. Okay, the number is really not important. When you're talking just strictly about the number of concussions, that, you know, did they recover in between each concussion, or did they just have one concussion after another and they're accumulating symptoms? You know, these are very different scenarios and they mean different things.
Steph, I'm glad you mentioned that, because so many people say, you know, what's the number? Like there's a magic number. Everybody's looking for a magic way to simplify this. For example, how long somebody should be out from a sport after a concussion, right? They'll often go to the emergency room and say, okay, you can go back in 2 weeks. Like there is a magic number. Can you address this idea of when can someone go back to their sport?
Yeah, it really, again, is sort of case by case. The concussion symptoms can change on a daily basis. They certainly peak in the first few days, and then they should really follow a curve coming back down on their own. Now, if someone's not following that curve, then we obviously need to get involved. But, you know, really the point is that it's a day-by-day condition. And, you know, I work with a lot of athletic trainers, and they understand this. And that's really the boots on the ground for a lot of teams, is having these excellent athletic trainers to manage a lot of the day-to-day issues that can come up as the symptoms change.
Now that you've brought this up, and I'm glad you have, about it being individualized in terms of return, can you talk a little bit about the tests? Because everybody wants a magic test, right? The impact test originally, and this is, I don't know, what is it, 10, 15 years ago, impact test would tell you when the person goes back, right? Or we see all these other tests that have come out since then, computerized tests. Well, if he passes this test, or he or she can go back to their sport. Can you address these tests, both computerized and otherwise?
Absolutely. These computerized tests are sort of standardized, and they're not individualized. And in a lot of ways, I know athletes who openly admit that they will do worse on their baseline computer test so that when they are concussed, they can continue to play. And so the fact that they could game the test is a real problem. The test retest reliability of the tests themselves is really poor as well. So if somebody takes it once and they take it again right after or the next day, they could get completely different scores. And so, you know, without even having a head injury. So that to me is a concern, and it really needs to be, there is no magic test. There's no go, no go from one test. It has to be a history, an examination, maybe some of these tools, but you have to put them all into context of what's going on.
So Steph, what can people do? I mean, in terms of how do you best prepare an athlete for the case where they may have a concussion? Are there certain exercises they should be doing? Is there something they should be doing part of their training other than wearing the proper equipment? Can you give us some insight into this? Because we're seeing all these different gizmos, right? We've seen the various collars they're trying to sell people and a variety of other things. Can you address what someone can do in terms of preparing if they were to have a concussion?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of these devices and collars and different things out there, you know, really is a marketing ploy. And, you know, physiologically, there is no real good evidence that says that these really do prevent concussion. And some of them are even potentially harmful. So I really discourage some of those as well. But proactive things to do, I always have, especially young athletes, you know, where their neck might be thin or weak, to really do some neck strengthening. I think that is one thing. There's mixed literature on that. It's not very solid, but it's harmless to strengthen your neck. So I always recommend people do that because it may be potentially helpful. And, you know, really just having a good understanding of concussion symptoms and the recognition, I think, is very important so that kids don't continue to play if they may be concussed. They need to recognize it for themselves and that the adults around them are also educated to a degree on this as well.
Steph, an email question just came in, and I'll just throw this out to you. Can mouth guards help avoid concussion?
Again, yeah, the literature on that is also very spotty, and, you know, it doesn't make great, you know, it makes theoretical sense, I guess, right, where you could put a mouth guard and maybe protect some, reduce some force to the brain that way. But again, there's no literature that supports that it can prevent concussion, no.
But it does prevent dental injuries.
Yes, so it's meant for dental.
So we obviously...
We still want you to wear it, yes.
Yeah. no matter what. And the basic one is pretty good, not the $900 mouth guard. And there are, those are out there. So I guess be careful of that. Steph, let's talk about the program you've just started at the Iyer Neuroscience Institute in terms of working with young athletes and something that parents and grandparents could become involved in.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this program. It's for the neurologic function monitoring program. So what we do is take healthy athletes who want to be competitive, any age from 12 years old or older, and they would come in during their off season every year and receive a thorough neurologic history, neurologic examination, as well as some cognitive testing that is not computerized and is more clinical. And then also we perform a depression screening just to, again, address any aspect of the neurologic and some psychologic components of sports so that folks can continue to play. And if there are symptoms or new changes on those evaluations from year to year as we check them, then we would identify those factors and address them so that the athletes can continue to play and compete at their highest level as much as they want to.
Well, you've touched on the psychological aspects and testing that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly, you know, mental health is a very important topic. I think it's completely unavoidable when you're treating athletes because they have to perform at a high level, especially student athletes, where they have to perform highly in school in order to then perform highly in their sport. You know, people really look at the GPA and the NCAA and things like that. So those folks really have a lot of stress on them. They do. And there's really no avoiding the conversation on the psychological components of playing sports. And, you know, depression is right there. Anxiety is right there. And so really that can impact a player's neurologic function and especially how well they play or how well they perform. And so, again, it should be a big part of the conversation when we're trying to identify ways to improve someone's performance.
Yeah, I think one of the things you and I always ask an athlete is, do you still want to play this sport? And it pertains at all different levels, really. It seems like a really basic question, but from the standpoint that, you know, does the child feel pressured to playing the sport rather than doing it for enjoyment? Steph, how long does the evaluation take? How much does it cost? How do people get the test done?
So the testing would be conducted in the office. It's non-invasive. It's in the office. And we accept insurance for that. So Hartford HealthCare accepts about 99% of health insurances. And so they can do the test with us. Our phone number is 860-524-4330.
How long does it take?
It takes the first time probably about 30 minutes to do the whole assessment and history. But then the follow-up years, it should be shorter than that.
Steph, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show today and jumping in here. And more importantly, I want to thank you for your tireless work. I know how much work this has taken for you and for your family to devote to this, really to the health of young athletes, and that's what it's all about. You've made Mom and I very proud. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Love you.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and we're wrapping up today's program. It's been great to be with you. I will be out on the field today at the UConn-Duke football game, and hopefully the weather will hold up to some degree. Next week, we're going to have a taped program, but I'm going to bring back the interview we did. It was an extended interview with Dr. David Banik, at which time we really discussed the vaccines. And it's timely now because we're talking about getting vaccinated for flu, COVID, and respiratory syncytial virus. As many of you are trying to get out there and get these vaccines. I got my flu shot this week. We often talk about timing these injections. Right now at UConn, we're vaccinating the medical staff now. Some people like to wait until October. Fine, but we're starting to see flu sooner. And as many of you know, we're starting to see more and more COVID affecting people, some people more severe than others. So be mindful of when it's time to put a mask on and when you feel you can go without a mask. So be mindful of that. If you're in crowded areas, there's a good chance somebody is there with COVID. Many thanks again to my guest today, Dr. Stephanie Alessi-LaRosa. Once again, trying to reach out to her for this exciting program at the Iyer Neuroscience Institute, it's 860-524-4330. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. And I look forward to chatting with you again next week. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. You could download that free at Audacy.com or Apple Podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.